French other than a nice pot of coq au vin. Something involving Saladin. I want to remind you that it was my country he attacked last November, not yours. And if anyone's going to get him, it's me. Any ops in the works? Several. Any of them about to bear fruit? Not a one. Yours? Gabriel was silent. I've never been shy about crashing operational parties, said Carter. All it would take is a single phone call to the chief of the DGSI, and it would be mine. He doesn't know about it. Must be a good one, then.
Must be, agreed Gabriel.
Perhaps I can contribute.
And thus preserve your hold on the Directorate of Operations?
Absolutely.
I appreciate your honesty, Adrian. It's refreshing in our line of work.
Desperate times, said Carter.
How much do you need to remain viable?
At this point, nothing short of Saladin can save me.
In that case, said Gabriel, I might be able to help. They spoke in the drawing room, bundled in their overcoats, without the distraction of refreshment. Gabriel's version of the operation thus far was abridged, but honest enough so that nothing was lost in translation. Carter did not flinch at the mention of Jean-Luc Martel's name. Carter was a man of the real world. He offered support where he could, mainly in the form of electronic and digital surveillance, America's strong suit. In return, Gabriel allowed Carter to take the operation to the 7th floor of Langley and present it as a joint undertaking between the agency and its friends in Tel Aviv. From Gabriel's point of view, it was a high price to pay, and not without risk. But if it kept Carter in his job, it would be worth its weight in gold. They left the safe house together shortly before 8 o'clock and rode to Dulles Airport, where Bill Blackburn's Gulfstream sat fueled and ready for departure. The crew had already filed a flight plan to Ben-Gurion, but upon entering the aircraft, Gabriel asked to be taken to London instead. Stretched out on the bed in the private stateroom, he fell into a dreamless sleep. His mind was at peace for the first time in many days. He was about to make an old friend quite wealthy. It was, he thought, the least he could do. Chapter 24 Mayfair, London. Julian Isherwood was a man of many faults, but parsimony was not among them. Indeed, in his business dealings, as in his private life, he had always been rather too free with his wallet. He had acquired a good many paintings when he should have passed. His personal and professional collection was said to rival that of the Queen herself. And, invariably, it was his credit card that ended up on the collection plate each evening in the bar at Wilton's. Not surprisingly, his finances were in a state of perpetual disrepair. Of late, the situation had grown dire. His cheerless accountant, the appropriately named Blunt, had suggested a fire sale of available assets, coupled with a sharp reduction in outlays. Isherwood had balked. Most of his professional inventory was of little or no value. It was dead as a doornail, as they said in the trade. Burned to a crisp. Toast. And as for the idea of trimming his expenditures, well, that was simply out of the question. One had to live one's life, especially at his age. Besides, his actions on the night of the attack had imbued him with a sense of personal optimism. If juicy Julian Isherwood could risk his life to save others, anything was possible. It was this belief that brighter days were just over the horizon that compelled Isherwood to admit Brady Boswell, the director of a small but respected museum in the American Midwest, into his gallery in Mason's Yard late that afternoon. Boswell had a well-deserved reputation as a looker, not a buyer. He spent the better part of 2 hours pawing Isherwood's inventory before finally confessing that his acquisition budget was in worse condition than Isherwood's bank account, and that he was in no position to buy new carpeting for his museum, let alone a new painting to hang on its walls. Isherwood was tempted to tell Boswell that the next time he wanted to see old masters in London, he should try the National Gallery. Instead, he accepted the American's invitation to dinner, if only because he couldn't bear the thought of spending yet another evening listening to Tubby Oliver Dimbleby describing his latest sexual conquest. Boswell suggested Alain Ducasse at the Dorchester, and Isherwood, having no alternative at the tip of his tongue, agreed. They dined on Dorset crab and Dover sole, and between them drank two bottles of Domaine Billot Simon Le Clos Grand Cru Chablis. Boswell spent much of the evening lamenting his country's dreadful politics. Isherwood listened attentively. Inwardly, however, he wondered why it was that enlightened Americans always found it necessary to bash their country whenever they set foot in the mothership. "I'm thinking about leaving," Boswell was sputtering with indignation. "Everyone is."
"Everyone?"
"Well, not everyone, only people like me." Only the crashing Boers. America, thought Isherwood, would soon be a much more interesting place.
"Where would you go?"
"I'm eligible for Irish citizenship."
"Ireland? Good grief.
Or I might get a little place here in England, until things blow over."
"We have problems of our own. You're better off staying put."
The notion that modern England might not be a cultural paradise appeared to come as a shock to Brady Boswell. He was one of those Americans who formed their impressions of life in the United Kingdom by watching reruns of Masterpiece Theatre.
"A shame about the terrorist attacks," said Boswell.
"Yes," said Isherwood, vaguely.
"I was hoping to see something in the West End while I was here, but I'm not sure it's safe."
"Nonsense."
"Cognac?"
"Why not?"
Boswell ordered the most expensive on the list, and when the check arrived, he adopted Oliver Dimbleby's favorite pose, that of a bewildered survivor of a natural disaster.
"Whom are you seeing tomorrow?" asked Isherwood, as he discreetly slipped his credit card into the little leather coffin,
the card he hoped wouldn't automatically self-destruct when inserted into the reader.
"I have Jeremy Crabb in the morning, and Roddy Hutchinson in the afternoon. I trust you won't tell them about my little funding issues. I wouldn't want them to think I'm not playing it straight."
"Your secret is safe with me."
It wasn't, actually. In fact, Isherwood planned to call Roddy first thing in the morning and advise him to come down with a sudden case of malaria. Otherwise, Roddy would be the one footing the bill for Brady Boswell's next meal. Outside, Isherwood thanked Boswell for what had been the least enjoyable night out since his heroics at the Ivy. Then he placed the American in a cab — he was staying at some flea bag in Russell Square — and sent him on his way. Another taxi was waiting. Isherwood gave the driver the address for his house in Kensington and ducked into the back. But as the cab turned into Park Lane, he felt the pulse of his mobile phone against his heart. He assumed it was the obligatory thank you from Boswell, and for an instant considered ignoring it. Instead, he withdrew the phone and squinted at the screen. The message was terse, a command rather than a request, and appeared to have no point of origin. Therefore, it could have come from only one person. Isherwood smiled. His evening, he thought, was about to get much more interesting.
"Change in plan," he informed the driver. "Take me to Mason's Yard."
Isherwood's gallery occupied three floors of a sagging Victorian warehouse once owned by Fortnum and Mason. On one side were the offices of a minor Greek shipping company, on the other a pub that catered to pretty office girls who rode motor scooters. The door was fashioned of shatterproof glass and protected by three state-of-the-art locks. It yielded to Isherwood's gentle touch.
"Bloody hell," he whispered.
The limited space of the gallery had compelled Isherwood to arrange his empire vertically. Storerooms on the ground floor, business offices on the second, and on the third, a glorious formal exhibition room modeled on Paul Rosenberg's famous gallery in Paris, where Isherwood had spent many happy hours as a child. Entering, he reached for the light switch.
"Don't," said a voice from the opposite end of the room. "Leave them off."
Isherwood crept forward, sidestepping a museum-style ottoman, and joined the man who appeared to be contemplating a large landscape by Claude. The man, like the painting, was shrouded in darkness, but his green eyes, when fixed on Isherwood, seemed to glow as if from an inner source of heat.
"I was beginning to wonder," said Gabriel, "if your dinner would ever end."
"So was I," answered Isherwood glumly. "Mind telling me how you got in here?"
"You'll recall that we were the ones who installed your security system."
Isherwood did, indeed. He also recalled that the system received a serious upgrade after an operation involving a Russian arms dealer named Ivan Kharkov. "Congratulations, Julian. My friends in British intelligence tell me you were quite the hero the other night."
"Oh, that."
Isherwood gave a dismissive wave of his hand. "Don't be so modest. Bravery is in rather short supply these days. And to think it wouldn't have happened if that pretty young girlfriend of yours hadn't stood you up."
"Fiona? How on earth do you know about her?"
"The British gave me a copy of the text message she sent while you were sitting at the restaurant."
"Is nothing sacred?"
"They also showed me a few minutes of CCTV video," said Gabriel. "I'm proud of you, Julian. You saved a good many lives that night. I can only imagine how I must have looked, an aging Don Quixote tilting at windmills." Overhead, night rain pattered on the skylight.
"So what brings you to town?" asked Isherwood. "Business or pleasure?"
"I don't do pleasure, Julian. Not any more, at least."
"That makes two of us."
"That bad?"
"I'm in a bit of a dry patch, to say the least."
"How dry?"
"Saharan," said Isherwood.
"Perhaps I can provide a bit of rain."
"Nothing too dangerous, I hope. I'm not sure I can take any more excitement."
"No, Julian, it's not like that at all. I just need you to advise a friend of mine who's interested in building a collection."
"Israeli, this chap?"
"Russian, actually."
"Oh, dear. How does he make his money?"
"In ways he doesn't like to talk about."
"I see," said Isherwood. "I don't suppose this has anything to do with all the bombs that have been exploding lately?"
"It might."
"And if I agree to serve as this chap's advisor?"
"The standard rules for such relationships will apply."
"By that you mean I'll be able to charge him a commission for each painting I help him acquire?"
"Actually," said Gabriel, "you can gouge the hell out of him. He won't be paying much attention."
"He likes old masters, your man?"
"Adores them. But he appreciates contemporary works, too."
"I won't hold that against him. How much is he willing to spend?"
200, said Gabriel. "Maybe 3.
Isherwood frowned. "He won't get far with that."
"Million, Julian. 200 million.
"You can't be serious."
Gabriel's expression said that he was. "He'll be arriving in London in a few days. Run him round to the auction houses and the galleries. Buy carefully, but in a hurry. And make a bit of noise, Julian. I want people to notice."
"I can't do it on charm and good looks," said Isherwood. "I'll need actual money."
"Don't worry, Julian. The check is in the mail."
200 million? Asked Isherwood.
"Maybe 3.
3 is definitely better than 2.
Gabriel shrugged. "So, we'll do 3. Chapter 25. London, Geneva. Saladin struck again at 8:30 the following morning. The target was Antwerp's Centraal train station. 2 suicide bombers, 2 gunmen, 69 dead. Gabriel was in London's St. Pancras at the time, waiting to board a Eurostar to Paris. His train departed 40 minutes late, though no reason was given for the delay. It seemed Saladin had succeeded in creating a new normal in Western Europe.
"If he keeps this up," said Christian Bouchard, "he's going to run out of targets."
Bouchard had been waiting for Gabriel in the arrivals hall of the Gare du Nord. Now he was behind the wheel of an Alpha Group Citroën, racing eastward on the Boulevard de la Chapelle. He bore no visible traces of the injuries he had suffered in the attack on the Rue de Grenelle. If anything, the handsome Frenchman looked better than ever.
"By the way," he said, "I owe you an apology for the way I acted before the bombing. I'm only glad it wasn't your last impression of me."
"To be honest, Christian, I don't remember even seeing you that day."
Bouchard smiled in spite of himself.
"Where are you taking me?"
"A safe house out in the 20th.
"Any luck finding a new headquarters?"
"Not yet. We're a bit like the ancient Israelites," said Bouchard, "scattered to the four winds."
The safe flat was located in a modern apartment block not far from a kosher supermarket. Paul Rousseau, seated at a cheap linoleum table in the kitchen, smoked his pipe incessantly throughout Gabriel's briefing. Rousseau had reason to be uneasy. He had let loose a foreign intelligence service on a prominent French businessman and was now feasting on the fruit of a poisonous tree. In short, he was on very thin ice indeed.
"I'm not happy about the Americans. These days their priority seems to be mergers and acquisitions."
"I did it for one reason, and one reason only."
"Still," Rousseau nibbled thoughtfully on the end of his pipe, "how sure are you about the gallery?"
"I should know more by the end of the day."
"Because if you can prove the gallery is dirty, that's the idea, Paul. How soon do you intend to go operational?"
"As soon as I've acquired the necessary funding," said Gabriel.
"Is there anything else you require of us?"
"A property near Saint-Tropez. There's plenty to rent, especially at this time of year." "Actually, I'm not in the market for a rental."
"You wish to buy?"
Gabriel nodded. "In fact," he said, "I already have a property in mind."
"Which one?"
Gabriel answered. Rousseau appeared incredulous.
"The one that was owned by—"
"Yes, that's the one."
"It's frozen."
"So unfreeze it. Trust me, I'll make it well worth your while. The taxpayers of France will be grateful."
"How much are you prepared to offer?"
Gabriel lifted his eyes toward the ceiling. 12 million feels about right."
"Apparently, it's fallen into quite a state of disrepair."
"We intend to renovate."
"In Provence?" Rousseau shook his head. "I wish you the best of luck."
5 minutes later, having checked a few more mundane operational boxes, Gabriel was once more in the passenger seat of Bouchard's Citroën. This time they drove from the 20th arrondissement to the 12th and stopped on the Boulevard Diderot outside the Gare de Lyon. It looked as though it were under military occupation. It was the same at every train station in France.
"Sure you want to go in there?" asked Bouchard. "I can arrange a car if you prefer."
"I'll manage." Long lines stretched from the station's entrance, where heavily armed police were searching handbags and suitcases and questioning anyone, especially young men, remotely Arab in appearance. The new normal, thought Gabriel, as he was admitted into the soaring departure hall. The famous clock read 3:05. His train was boarding on track D. Track Dalit, he thought. Why did it have to be that one? Couldn't they have chosen another? He made his way along the platform, entered one of the first-class carriages, and settled into his assigned seat. Only when the memories had subsided did he draw his mobile. The number he dialed was in Bern. A man answered in Swiss German. Gabriel addressed him in the Berlin-accented German of his mother. "I'm on my way to your beautiful country, and I was wondering whether you might show me a good time." There was a silence, followed by a lengthy exhalation of breath.
"When are you getting in?"
6:15.
"How?"
"The TGV from Paris."
"What is it this time?"
"Same as the last, a quick peek, that's all."
"Nothing is going to explode, is it?"
Gabriel killed the connection and watched the platform sliding slowly past his window. Once again the memories arose. He saw a woman, scarred and prematurely gray, sitting in a wheelchair, and a man running wildly toward her, a gun in his hand. He closed his eyes and gripped the armrest to stop his hand from shaking. "I'll manage," he thought. The NDB, like Switzerland itself, was small but efficient. Headquartered in a drab office block in Bern, the service was responsible for keeping the many problems of a disorderly world from crossing the borders of the Swiss Confederation. It spied on the spies who plied their trade on Swiss soil, watched over the foreigners who hid their money in Swiss banks, and monitored the activities of the growing number of Muslims who made Switzerland their home. Thus far, the country had been spared a major terrorist attack by the likes of Al-Qaeda or ISIS. It was no accident. Christoph Pittel, the chief of the NDB's counterterrorism division, was very good at his job. He was also punctual as a Swiss watch. Tall and thin, he was leaning against the hood of a German sedan when Gabriel emerged from the Gare de Canavan in Geneva at 6:30. The Swiss secret policeman frowned. In Switzerland, 6:15 meant 6:15.
"Do you know the address for the vault?"
"Building 3, Corridor 8, Vault 19.
"Who's renting it?"
something called TXM Capital. But I suspect the real owner is JLM.
Jean-Luc Martel?
One and the same. Patel swore softly.
I don't want any trouble with the French. I need the DGSI to protect my western flank.
Don't worry about the French. As for your western flank, I'd be very afraid.
Is it true what they say about Martel? That his real business is drugs?
We'll know in a few minutes. They crossed the Rhone, and then, a moment later, the mucus-green waters of the Arno. To the south lay a quartier of Geneva where tourists and diplomats rarely ventured. It was a land of tidy warehouses and low-slung office blocks. It was also the home of the secretive Geneva Freeport, a secure, tax-free repository with a global super-rich stashed away treasures of every kind, gold bars, jewelry, vintage wine, automobiles, and, of course, art. It was not art to be viewed and cherished. It was art as a commodity, art as a hedge against uncertain times.
The place has changed since we were here, Bittel said. The last straw was that scandal involving the Modigliani, the one that had been stolen by the Nazis. A lot of the collectors pulled out after that and moved their holdings to places like Delaware and London. The cantonal authorities have brought in a new man to run the place. He's a former Swiss finance minister, a real stickler for the letter of the law.
Perhaps there's hope for your country after all.
Let's skip this part, said Bittel. I like it better when we're on the same side.
A row of featureless white structures appeared on their right, surrounded by an opaque green fence topped with concertina wire and security cameras. It might have been mistaken for a prison, were it not for the red and white sign that read, Port Franc. Bittel turned into the entrance and waited for the security gate to open. Then he pulled forward a few feet and slipped the car into park.
Building 3, Corridor 8, Vault 19.
Very good, said Gabriel.
We're not going to find drugs in there, are we?
No.
How can you be sure?
Because drug dealers don't lock away their product in secure tax-free storage facilities. They sell it to idiots who smoke it, snort it, and inject it into their veins. That's how they make their money. Patel entered the security office. Through the half-open blinds of the window, Gabriel could see him in close conversation with an attractive brunette. It was obvious they were speaking in French rather than Swiss-German. Finally, there were a few nods and assurances, and then a key changed hands. Patel carried it back to the car and slid behind the wheel again.
You're sure there's nothing between you two? Asked Gabriel. Don't start with that again.
Maybe you can introduce me. It would save you the trouble of having to make the drive down from Bern every time I need to look inside some criminal's vault.
I prefer our current system.
Patel parked outside Building 3 and led Gabriel inside. From the entrance stretched a seemingly endless hall of doors. They climbed a flight of stairs to the second level and made their way to Corridor 8. The door to Vault 19 was gray metal. Patel inserted the key into the lock and, entering, switched on the light. The vault contained two chambers. Both were filled with flat, rectangular wooden crates of the sort used to transport valuable art. All were identical in size, about 6 feet by 4.
Not again, said Bittel.
No, said Gabriel, not again. He examined one of the crates. Attached to it was a shipping waybill bearing the name Galerie Olivia Watson of Saint-Tropez. He pulled at the lid, but it wouldn't budge. It was nailed tightly into place. You wouldn't happen to have a claw hammer in your back pocket, would you?
Sorry.
How about a tire tool?
I might have one in the trunk.
Gabriel scrutinized the remaining crates while Bittel went downstairs. There were 48. All had come from Galerie Olivia Watson. TXM Capital was the recipient of record for 27 of the crates. The rest bore equally vague names, the kind of names, thought Gabriel, invented by clever lawyers and private bankers. Bittel returned with the tire tool. Gabriel used it to pry open the first crate. He worked slowly, gently, so as to leave as few marks in the wood as possible. Inside he found a canvas wrapped in glassine paper, resting in a protective frame of polyurethane. It was all very professional-looking, with the exception of the canvas itself.
"How contemporary,"
said Bittell. "There's no accounting for taste," replied Gabriel. He opened another crate. The contents were identical to the first. The same was true of the third crate and the fourth. A canvas wrapped in glycine paper, a protective frame of polyurethane. All very professional, except for the canvases themselves. They were blank.
"Mind telling me what this means?" asked Bittell.
"It means that Jean-Luc Martel's real business is drugs, and is using his girlfriend's art gallery to launder some of the profits.
Just what the Freeport needs. Another scandal."
"Don't worry, Christophe," Gabriel smiled. "It will be our little secret."
Chapter 26 Tel Aviv, Saint-Tropez. Which left only the money. The money necessary to take Gabriel's operations from development to the stage. The 200 or 300 million to acquire a flashy art collection. The 12 million for a lavish villa on Francis Côte d'Azur. And the 5 million, give or take, to make it presentable. And then there was the money for all of life's little extras. The cars, the clothes, the jewelry, the restaurants, the trips by private plane, the lavish parties. Gabriel had a figure in mind, to which he added another 20 million just in case. Operations, like life itself, were uncertain.
"That's a lot of cash," said the Prime Minister. "A 500 million doesn't go as far as it used to.
Where's the bank?"
"We have several to choose from, but the National Bank of Panama is our best option."
"One-stop shopping," explained Gabriel, "and little threat of retaliation. Not after the Panama Papers scandal. Even so, we'll plant a few false flags to cover our tracks."
"Who are you going to hang it on?"
"The North Koreans."
"Why not the Iranians?"
"Next time," promised Gabriel. The targeted funds were spread over 8 separate accounts, all bearing the name of the same Shell Investment Corporation. They were part of a vast fortune of looted money controlled by the ruler of Syria and its closest friends and relatives. Shortly before becoming chief, Gabriel had tracked down and then seized the lion's share of the fortune in a bid to moderate the ruler's murderous conduct in the Syrian civil war. But he had been compelled to return the money, more than $8 billion, in exchange for a single human life. He had paid the ransom without regret. It was, he always said, the best deal he had ever made. Even so, he had been looking for an excuse, any excuse, to have the final say. Finding Saladin was as good a reason as any. Gabriel had not returned the $8 billion directly to the Syrian ruler. He had deposited it, as instructed, in Gazprom Bank in Moscow, thus effectively placing it in the hands of the Tsar, the Syrian ruler's closest friend and benefactor. The Tsar had taken half of the money for himself, service charges, carrying costs, shipping and handling. The remaining funds, slightly more than $4 billion, had been deposited in a string of secret accounts in Switzerland, Luxembourg, Liechtenstein, Dubai, Hong Kong, and, of course, the National Bank of Panama. Gabriel knew this because, with the help of a highly secretive unit of office computer hackers, he had been watching the money's every move. The unit had no official name because, officially, it did not exist. Those who had been briefed on its work referred to it only as the Minion, for the unit was 10 in number and exclusively male in gender. With but a few keystrokes, they could darken a city, blind an air traffic control network, or make the centrifuges of an Iranian nuclear enrichment plant spin wildly out of control. In short, they had the ability to turn machines against their masters. Privately, Uzi Nawat referred to the Minion as 10 good reasons why no one in his right mind would ever use a computer or a mobile phone. The Minion worked in a room just down the hall from the one where Gabriel's team was putting the final touches on the pre-operational planning. Its nominal leader was a kid named Ilan. He was the cyber equivalent of Mozart. First computer code at 5, first hack at 8, first covert op against the Iranians at 21. He was thin as a pauper and had the pasty white pallor of someone who didn't get outside much.
"All I have to do is push a button," he said with an impish smile. "And poof, the money is gone."
"And no fingerprints?"
"Only North Korean."
"And there's no way they'll be able to trace the money from the Bank of Panama to HSBC in Paris?"
Not a chance.
Remind me, said Gabriel, to keep my money under the mattress.
Keep your money under the mattress.
It was a rhetorical point, Ilan. I didn't want you to actually remind me.
Oh.
You have to get out into the real world once in a while.
This is the real world.
Gabriel stared at the computer screen. Ilan stared at it, too. Well? Asked Gabriel.
Well, what?
What are you waiting for?
Authorization. To steal $500 million.
It's not stealing.
I doubt the Syrians will see it that way.
Or the Panamanians. Push the button, Ilan.
I'd feel better if you did it.
Which one? Ilan indicated the enter key. Gabriel tapped it once. Then he walked down the hall and informed his team of the news. The necessary funding had come through. They were open for business. He was spotted for the first time the following week on the Wednesday, coming out of Bonham's on New Bond Street with Julian Isherwood at his heels. As luck would have it, or perhaps with the benefit of hindsight, it wasn't luck at all, Amelia March of Art News happened to be standing on the pavement at the time, killing a few minutes before her 2 o'clock with the chairman of Bonham's post-war and contemporary department. She was an art journalist, not a real one, but she had a nose for a story and an eye for detail. Tall, trim, quite blonde, rather pale, no color in the eyes at all. His suit and overcoat were perfect. His cologne smelled of money. She thought it odd he was in the company of a fossil like Julian. He looked as though his tastes ran to modern rather than angels and saints and martyrs. Isherwood gave a hurried introduction before ducking with his accomplice into the back of a waiting Jaguar limo. Dimitri something rather. But of course. Inside Bonham's, Amelia was able to determine that Isherwood and his tall, pale friend had spent several hours with Jeremy Crabb, the auction house's maestro of old masters. She tracked down Jeremy at Wilton's later that evening. They spoke like a couple of spies in a Vienna coffee house after the war.
Name's Antonov. Dmitry Antonov. Russian, I suppose, but it didn't come up in casual conversation. He's absolutely made of money. Does something with natural resources.
Don't they all? Drawled Jeremy.
Julian's attached himself like a barnacle to the hull of a ship.
Apparently he's acting as both dealer and advisor.
Quite a cozy relationship, financially speaking. It seems Dmitri has taken several paintings off Julian's hands, and now they're hunting big game. But don't quote me on that. In fact, don't quote me on anything. This is all off the record. Strictly entre nous, darling.
Amelia agreed to keep the information confidential. But Jeremy wasn't so discreet. In fact, he told everyone in the bar, including Oliver Dimbleby. By evening's end, it was all anyone was talking about. In mid-March, they were spotted at both Christie's and Sotheby's. They also paid a visit to Oliver's gallery in Berry Street, where after an hour of benign negotiation, they committed to acquire a hilly dunescape by the Dutch painter Jacob van Rijsdael, 2 Venetian canal scenes by Francesco Guardi, and an entombment by Zelotti. Roddy Hutchinson sold him 5 paintings in all, including a still life with fruit and a lizard by Ambrosius Boschart II. The next day, Amelia March published a small piece about a young Russian who was making waves in the London art market. Julian Isherwood, acting as the young Russian's spokesman, declined comment.
Any purchases made by my client were private, he said, and they will remain so.
Early April saw Isherwood and his Russian friend across the Atlantic in New York, where their arrival was eagerly anticipated. They toured the auction houses and the galleries, dined in all the right restaurants, and even took in a Broadway musical. A gossip columnist from the Post reported they acquired several old master paintings from Otto Naumann Limited on East 80th Street, but once again Isherwood mumbled something about his client's desire for privacy. By all accounts, it went only so far. Those who met him were left with the impression he was a man who liked to be seen. The same was true of the beautiful young woman, apparently she was the wife, but this was never proven irrefutably, who accompanied him to America. She was trim, dark, French, and deeply unfriendly. Never missed an opportunity to have a look at herself.
said the manager of an exclusive Fifth Avenue jeweler. A real piece of work. But who was this man named Dmitri Antonov? And perhaps more important, where did he get his money? He was soon the focus of many Gatsby-esque rumors, some malicious, others well-placed. It was said that he had killed a man, that he had killed many men, and that he had come by his fortune illicitly, all of which happened to be true. Not that it made him any less palatable to those who sold art for a living. They didn't much care how he made his money, so long as the check arrived on time and there were no problems at the other end. There weren't. He banked reputably at HSBC in Paris, but curiously, all his purchases were forwarded to a vault in the Geneva Freeport. "He's one of those," said a woman who worked in the business office at Sotheby's. A superior quietly reminded her that those were the ones who kept places like Sotheby's in business. The vault in the Freeport was the closest thing he had to a permanent address. In London, he lived at the Dorchester, in Paris, at the Hôtel de Crillon, and when business took him to Zurich, only the Terrazza suite at the Dolder Grand would do. Even Julian Isherwood, who was tethered to him by cell phone and text, claimed not to know where he was from one day to the next. But there were rumors. Here again, there were only rumors. He had acquired a castle for himself somewhere in France. "He's using the Freeport as a temporary storage facility," Isherwood whispered into Oliver Dimbleby's ear. "Something big is in the works." Isherwood then swore Oliver to absolute secrecy, thus ensuring the news would go global by morning. But where in France? Once again, the rumor mill began to turn, for on the day the man called Dmitri Antonov left New York, there appeared a small item in Nice Matin regarding a certain notorious piece of real estate near Saint-Tropez. Known as Villa Soleil, the sprawling seaside compound on the Bay de Cavalier was once owned by Ivan Kharkov, the Russian oligarch and arms dealer who was shot to death outside an exclusive Saint-Tropez restaurant. For nearly a decade, the property had been in the hands of the French government. Now, for reasons never made clear, the government was suddenly anxious to remove Villa Soleil from its books. Apparently a buyer had been found. Nice Matin, despite strenuous efforts, had not yet been able to identify him. Renovation of the property commenced immediately. Indeed, on the day after the article appeared, an army of painters, plumbers, electricians, stonemasons, landscapers descended on Villa Soleil and remained there without interruption until the great palace by the sea was once again fit for human habitation. The enterprising nature of the workforce provoked no small amount of resentment among the neighbors, all of whom were battle-scarred veterans of Provençal construction projects. Even Jean-Luc Martel, who lived in a grand villa on the opposite side of the bay, was impressed by the speed with which the project was completed. Gabriel and the team knew this because, with the help of the mighty American NSA, they were now privy to all of Martel's private communications, including the molten email he sent to his builder wondering why a renovation to his pool house was 2 months behind schedule. "Finish it by the end of April," he wrote, "or I'll fire you and hire the company that did Ivan's old place." The interior decoration of Villa Soleil was conducted at the same unprovençal pace overseen by one of the Côte d'Azur's most prominent firms. There was only one delay: a pair of matching couches ordered from Olivia Watson's design shop in Saint-Tropez. Owing to a minor clerical error, in truth it was quite intentional, the name of the villa's owner appeared on the order form. Olivia Watson shared the name with Martel, who in turn gave it to a columnist at Nice Matin who had written favorably of him in the past. Gabriel and his team knew this because the mighty American NSA said it was so. Which left only the paintings. The paintings acquired under the flawless eye of Julian Isherwood and stored in a vault in the Geneva Freeport. In mid-May, they were transported to Provence in a convoy of panel vans, watched over by agents of a private security firm and several officers of a secret unit of the DGSI known as the Alpha Group. Isherwood supervised the hanging with the assistance of the owner's French wife. Then they flew to Paris, where the owner himself was staying in his usual suite at the Crillon. That evening they dined at Martel's thriving new restaurant on the Boulevard Saint-Germain, accompanied by a durable-looking man who spoke French with a pronounced
Corsican accent. Martel was there, too, along with his glamorous English girlfriend. Gabriel and his team were not surprised by the presence of their quarry. They had known of Martel's plans several days in advance, and had reserved a table for four under the name Dmitri Antonov. Within minutes of the party's arrival, a bottle of champagne appeared, along with a handwritten note. The champagne was a 1998 Dom Pérignon. The note was from Jean-Luc Martel. "Welcome to the neighborhood. See you in Saint-Tropez." It was, all in all, a promising beginning. Chapter 27 Côte d'Azur, France.
I think I'll go into the village a little later.
Whatever for?
It's market day. You know how much I love the market.
Ah, yes, wonderful.
Can you come?
Can't, unfortunately. I have a few calls to make.
Fine.
10 days had elapsed since Mikhail and Natalie, otherwise known as Dmitri and Sophie Antonov, had settled into their new home on the Baie des Cavaliers, and already it seemed they were bored. It was not operational boredom. It was marital in nature. Gabriel had declared the Antonovs would not be an entirely blissful union. Few marriages were perfect, he argued, and the marriage between a Russian criminal and a Frenchwoman of dubious personal provenance would not be without its rough patches. He had also decreed that they were to maintain their cover identities at all times, even when they were safely behind the 12-foot walls of Villa Soleil. Thus, the frigid exchange over breakfast. It was conducted in English, as Dmitri Antonov's French was atrocious, and his wife's Russian was non-existent. The household staff, all officers of Paul Rousseau's Alpha Group, addressed only Madame Sophie. Monsieur Antonov they generally avoided. They thought him rude and coarse, and he regarded them, with some justification, as the worst domestic servants in all of Provence. Gabriel shared his opinion. Privately, he had urged Rousseau to knock them quickly into shape. Otherwise, they risked sinking the entire operation. Mikhail and Natalie were seated like characters in a film, at a table on the broad colonnaded terrace overlooking the pool. It was the spot where they had taken their breakfast each of the 9 preceding mornings, for Monsieur Antonov preferred it above all others. He had started his day with a vigorous 30-minute swim in the pool. Now he wore a snowy white toweling robe against his pale skin. Natalie's eye was drawn to the rivulet of water running through the chiseled creek bed of his abdominal muscles toward the waistband of his bathing suit. Quickly she looked away. Madame Sophie, she reminded herself, was annoyed with Monsieur Antonov. He could not worm his way back into her good graces with a petty display of physical beauty. She poured a cup of strong black coffee from the silver pot and added a generous measure of steamed milk. In doing so, she looked undeniably French. Next, she plucked a gitane from its packet and lit it. The cigarettes, like her churlish demeanor, were purely for the sake of her cover. A physician, who had seen firsthand the terrible effects of tobacco on the human body, she was a devout non-smoker. The first inhalation clawed at the back of her throat, but with a sip of the coffee, she managed to suppress the urge to cough. It was very nearly perfect, the coffee. Only in the south of France, she thought, did it taste like this. The morning was clear and fine, with a soft wind that moved in the line of cypress pines marking the boundary between Villa Soleil and its neighbor. Wavelets flecked the Baie des Cavaliers, across which Natalie could make out the faint lines of the villa owned by Jean-Luc Martel, hôtelier, restaurateur, clothier, jeweler, and international dealer of illicit narcotics. "Croissant?" she asked.
"Pardon?"
Mikhail was reading something on a tablet computer with great intensity, and could not be bothered to lift his gaze to meet hers.
"I asked whether you wanted another croissant."
"No."
"How about lunch?"
"Now?"
"In Saint-Tropez. You can meet me there."
"I'll try. What time?"
"Lunch time, darling. The time people usually eat lunch."
He swiped her forefinger across the surface of the tablet, but said nothing. Natalie stabbed out her cigarette, and in the manner of Sophie Antonov stood abruptly. Then she leaned down and put her mouth close to Mikhail's ear.
"You seem to be enjoying this too much,"
she whispered in Hebrew.
"I wouldn't get used to it if I were you."
She entered the villa and padded barefoot through its many cavernous rooms, until she came to the base of the grand main staircase. Her accommodations, she thought, were far better than the ones she had endured in her first operation. The drab flat in the Paris banlieue of Aubervilliers, her squalid little room in an ISIS dormitory in Raqqa, the desert training camp outside Palmyra, the chamber in the house in Mosul where she had nursed Saladin back to health. You are my Maimonides. In the bedroom, the satin sheets were still in disarray. Evidently, the Alpha Group maids had not found time in their busy schedule to put the room in order. Natalie smiled guiltily. This was the one room in the house where she and Mikhail made no attempt to conceal their true feelings for one another. Strictly speaking, their actions the previous evening had been a violation of office regulations, which forbade intimate relations between operatives in the field. It was famously one of the least enforced rules in the entire service. Indeed, the current chief and his wife were known to have disregarded the rule on numerous occasions. Besides, thought Natalie as she straightened the sheets, their lovemaking was for the sake of their cover. Even quarreling spouses were not immune to the dark pull of desire. The walk-in closet was overflowing with designer clothing, shoes and accessories, all paid for by the murderous ruler of Syria. Only the best for Madame Sophie. From a drawer, she removed a pair of Lycra leggings and a sports bra. Her Nike trainers were on the shoe rack next to a pair of Bruno Mali pumps. Dressed, she walked down a cool marble hall to the fitness room and stepped onto the treadmill. She hated running indoors, but had no other option. Madame Sophie was not permitted to run outside. Madame Sophie had security issues. So too did Natalie Mizrahi. She slipped on a pair of headphones and set out at an easy jog, but with each kilometer she increased the speed of the belt until she was clipping along at a brisk pace. Her breathing remained controlled and steady. The many weeks she had spent at the farm in Nahalal had left her in peak fitness. She finished with a final sprint and spent 30 minutes lifting weights before returning to the bedroom to shower and dress. White capri pants, a snug-fitting stretch pullover that flattered her breasts and slender waist, gold flat-soled sandals. Standing before the mirror, she thought again of the last operation, the hijab and pious clothing of Dr. Leila Hadawi. Leila, she thought, would not have approved of Sophie Antonov. In that, she and Natalie were in complete agreement. She stepped onto the balcony and peered down toward the terrace where Mikhail was stretched on a chaise longue, exposing his colorless skin to the morning rays of the sun. In 10 days his pallor had not changed. He seemed to be incapable of tanning. "Sure you won't join me?" she called down. "I'm busy." Natalie dropped her office mobile into her handbag and headed downstairs to the forecourt, where the Antonov's black Maybach limousine waited next to the splashing fountain, an Alpha Group driver behind the wheel. In the back seat was a second officer of the Alpha Group. His name was Roland Girard. During the first operation he had served as the director of the small clinic in Aubervilliers where Dr. Leila Hadawi had practiced medicine. Now he was Madame Sophie's favorite bodyguard. There were rumors they were having a torrid affair, rumors that had reached the ears of Monsieur Antonov. Several times he had tried to fire the bodyguard, but Madame Sophie would not hear of it. As the Maybach eased through the imposing security gate, she lit another gitane and stared moodily out her window. This time she could not suppress the urge to cough.
"You know," said Girard, "you don't have to smoke those wretched things when it's just the two of us."
"It's the only way I'll ever get used to them."
"What are your plans?" he asked.
"The market."
"And then?"
"I was hoping to have lunch with my husband, but it seems he can't be bothered."
Girard smiled, but said nothing. Just then, Natalie's mobile pinged with an incoming message. After reading it, she returned the device to her handbag and, coughing, smoked the last of the gitane. It was nearly time for Madame Sophie to meet Madame Olivia. She needed the practice.
Chapter 28 Saint-Tropez, France. As they passed the turnoff for the Plage de Pamplon, Natalie was overcome by memories. This time, they were not Leila's memories, they were her own. It is a perfect morning in late August.
Natalie and her parents have made the difficult drive from Marseille to Saint-Tropez because no other beach in France, or the world for that matter, will do. The year is 2011. Natalie has completed her medical training and has embarked on what promises to be a successful career in France's state-run healthcare system. She is a model French citizen. She cannot imagine living anywhere else. But France is changing rapidly beneath her feet. It is no longer a place where it is safe to be a Jew. Each day, it seems, brings news of another horror. Another child beaten or spat upon. Another shop window broken. Another synagogue sprayed with graffiti. Another gravestone toppled. And so, on that day in late August, on the beach at Pamplona, Natalie and her parents do their best to conceal their Jewishness. They cannot, and the day does not pass without scornful looks and a murmured insult by the waiter who grudgingly serves their lunch. During the drive back to Marseille, Natalie's parents make a fateful decision. They will leave France and settle in Israel. They ask Natalie, their only child, to join them. She agrees without hesitation, and now, she thought, gazing out the tinted window of the Maybach limousine, she was back again. Beyond the beaches were newly planted vineyards and tiny villas shaded by cypress and umbrella pine. Once they reached the outer edges of Saint-Tropez, however, the villas were concealed by high walls covered in flowering vines. These were the homes of the merely rich. Not the super-rich like Dmitri Antonov or Ivan Kharkov before him. As a child, Natalie had dreamed of living in a grand house, surrounded by walls. Gabriel had granted her wish. Not Gabriel, she thought suddenly. It was Saladin. The driver eased the Maybach onto the Avenue Foch and followed it into the Centre-Ville. It was only June, not yet high summer, and so the crowds were manageable, even in the Place de Lys, site of Saint-Tropez's bustling open-air market. As Natalie made her way slowly through the stalls, she felt an overwhelming sense of loss. This was her country, she thought, and yet her family had been forced to leave it because of the most ancient hatred. The presence of Roland Girard focused her attention on the task at hand. He walked not at her side, but at her back. There was no mistaking him for a husband. He was there for one reason, and one reason only: to protect Madame Sophie Antonov, the new resident of the scandalous palace on the Baie des Cavaliers. All at once she heard someone calling her name from a café along the Boulevard Vassero. "Madame Sophie! Madame Sophie! It's me! Nicolas! Over here, Madame Sophie!" She looked up and saw Christopher Keller, waving to her from a table at Le Clemenceau. Smiling, she crossed the street, with Roland Girard a step behind. Keller rose and offered her a chair. When Natalie sat down, Roland Girard returned to the Place de Lys and stood in the dappled shade of a plane tree. "What a pleasant surprise," said Keller when they were alone. "Yes, it is." Natalie's tone was cool. It was the voice Madame Sophie used when addressing men who worked for her husband. "What brings you into the village?" "An errand. You?" "A bit of shopping." She glanced around the market. "Anyone watching?" "Of course, Madame Sophie, you caused quite a stir." "That was the point, wasn't it?" Keller was drinking Campari. "Have you had a chance to visit any of the art galleries?" he asked. "Not yet." "There's a rather good one near the Old Port. I'd be happy to show it to you. It's a 5-minute walk at most." "Will the owner be there?"
"I'd say so, yes."
"How does our friend want me to play it?" "He seems to think a good snub is in order." Natalie smiled. "I think Madame Sophie can manage that quite nicely." They walked toward the Old Port, past the parade of shops lining the Rue Gambetta. Keller wore white pants, black moccasins, and a form-fitting black pullover. With his dark tan and gelled hair, he looked thoroughly disreputable. Natalie, playing the role of Madame Sophie, affected a deep and profound boredom. She loitered in several of the shop windows, including a boutique that bore the name Olivia Watson. Roland Girard, her ersatz bodyguard, stood vigilantly at her shoulder. "What do you think of that one?" she asked, pointing toward a sheer dress that hung from a headless mannequin like a negligee.
Do you think Dmitri would notice me if I wore that? Or how about that one? That might get his attention.
Greeted by a professional silence, she walked on, swinging her handbag like a spoiled schoolgirl. Josie Gavish and Ramona Stern were walking toward them along the narrow street, hands clasped, laughing at a private joke. Dina Sarid was evaluating a pair of sandals in the window of Minelli, and a little farther along the street, Natalie spotted Elie Lavon rushing into a pharmacy with the urgency of a man whose bowels were in a state of rebellion. At last, they arrived in the Place de l'Homo. It was not a proper square like the Place de Lys, but a tiny triangle at the intersection of three streets. In the center was an old wellhead, shaded by a single tree. On one side was a dress shop, on the other a café, and next to the café was the handsome four-story building, large by Saint-Tropez standards, pale gray instead of tan, occupied by Galerie Olivia Watson. The heavy wooden door was closed and locked. Next to it was a brass placard, which stated in both French and English that viewing of the gallery's inventory was by appointment only. In the display window were three paintings, a Lichtenstein, a Basquiat, and a work by the French painter and sculptor Jean Dubuffet. Natalie wandered over to have a closer look at the Basquiat, while Keller checked his mobile. After a moment, she became aware of a presence at her back. The intoxicating scent of lilac made it clear it was not Roland Giral.
"Beautiful, isn't it?"
asked a female voice in French.
"The Basquiat?"
"Yes." "Actually," said Natalie to the glass, "I prefer the Dubuffet."
"You have good taste."
Natalie turned slowly and appraised the fourth work of art, standing a few inches away, in the Place de l'Homo. She was shockingly tall, so tall in fact that Natalie had to lift her gaze to meet hers. She was not beautiful. She was professionally beautiful. Until that moment, Natalie had not realized there was a difference.
"Would you like to have a closer look?"
the woman asked.
"I'm sorry?"
"At the Dubuffet. I have a few minutes before my next appointment." She smiled and extended a hand.
"Forgive me, I should have introduced myself. I'm Olivia, Olivia Watson," she added. "This is my gallery."
Natalie accepted the proffered hand. It was unusually long, as was the bare arm, smooth and golden, to which it was attached. Luminous blue eyes stared out from a face so flawless it scarcely seemed real. It was set in an expression of mild curiosity.
"You're Sophie Antonov. Are you not? Have we met?"
"No, but Saint-Tropez is a small town."
"Very small," said Natalie coolly.
"We live across the bay from you and your husband," Olivia Watson explained. "In fact, we can see your villa from ours. Perhaps you'd like to come over sometime."
"I'm afraid my husband is extremely busy."
"He sounds like Jean-Luc."
"Jean-Luc is your husband?"
"Partner," said Olivia Watson. "His name is Jean-Luc Martel. Perhaps you've heard of him? You and your husband had dinner at his new brasserie in Paris a couple of weeks ago. He sent you a bottle of champagne."
She glanced at Keller, who appeared to be engrossed by something he was reading on his mobile.
"He was there, too.
He works for my husband."
"And that one?"
Olivia Watson nodded toward Roland Girard.
"He works for me."
The luminous blue eyes settled on Natalie once more. She had studied hundreds of photographs of Olivia Watson in preparation for their first encounter, and yet the impact of her beauty was still a shock to the system. She was smiling slightly now. It was a sly smile, seductive, superior. She was well aware of the effect her appearance had on other women.
"Your husband is an art collector," she said.
"My husband is a businessman who appreciates art," said Natalie carefully.
"Perhaps he'd like to visit the gallery."
"My husband prefers old master paintings to contemporary works."
"Yes, I know. He made quite a splash in London and New York this spring."
She delved into her handbag and produced the business card which she offered to Natalie.
"My private number's on the back. I have some special pieces I think might be of interest to your husband. And please come to our villa for lunch this weekend. Jean-Luc is eager to meet you both."
"My husband and I have other plans this weekend," said Natalie briskly.
Good day, Madame Wilson. It was a pleasure to meet you. Watson, she called out as Natalie walked away. My name is Olivia Watson. She was still holding the business card between her thumb and forefinger. Keller walked over and plucked it from her grasp. Madame Sophie can be a bit on the moody side. Don't worry. I'll have a word with the boss on your behalf. He offered his hand. I'm Nicolas, by the way. Nicolas Carnot. Keller walked with Natalie and Roland Gérard back to the Place de Lys and saw them into the waiting Maybach. It departed the Centreville a few seconds later in a black blur observed enviously by tourists and natives alike. Alone, Keller walked through the stalls of the market to the opposite side of the square and mounted the Peugeot Satellite motorbike he had left there. He headed west along the edge of the Golf de Saint-Tropez, then south into the hills of the Var, until he came to the village of Ramatuelle. It was not unlike the village of the Ossatis in central Corsica. A cluster of small, dun-colored houses with red-tile roofs perched defensively atop a hill. There were larger villas hidden away in the wooded lowlands. One was called La Pastorale. Keller made certain he was not being followed before presenting himself at the iron security gate. It was painted green and quite formidable. He thumbed the intercom button and then turned to watch a delivery truck pass in the road. Oui? Came a thin, metallic voice a moment later. C'est moi, said Keller. Open the fucking gate! The drive was long and winding, and shaded by pine and poplar. It terminated in the gravel forecourt of a large stone villa with yellow shutters. Keller made his way to the sitting room, which had been converted into a makeshift op center. Gabriel and Paul Rousseau were hunched over a laptop computer. Rousseau acknowledged Keller's arrival with a guarded nod. He was still deeply suspicious of this talented MI6 officer who spoke French like a Corsican and was comfortable in the presence of criminals. But Gabriel was smiling broadly. Well played, Monsieur Carnot. Taking the business card was a nice touch. First impressions matter. They do indeed. Listen to this. Gabriel tapped the keyboard of the laptop, and a few seconds later came the voice of a woman shouting in anger in French. It was fluent and profane, but marked by an unmistakable English accent. Who's she talking to? Jean-Luc Martel, of course. How did he take it? You'll hear in a minute. Keller winced as Martel's voice boomed from the speakers. Clearly, said Gabriel, he's not used to people telling him no. What's your next move? Another snub. Several, in fact. The speakers fell silent after Olivia Watson, with one final fusillade of shouted obscenities, terminated the call. Keller walked over to an array of video monitors and watched a Maybach limousine turning into a palatial villa by the sea. A woman exited and made her way through cavernous rooms hung with old master paintings to a terrace overlooking a lagoon-sized swimming pool. A man dozed there, his pale skin reddening beneath the unrelenting onslaught of the sun. The woman spoke something directly into his ear that the microphones could not capture and led him upstairs to a room where there are no cameras. Keller smiled as the door closed. Perhaps there was hope for Madame Sophie and Monsieur Antonov, after all. Chapter 29 Côte d'Azur, France. It was not true that Madame Sophie and Monsieur Antonov had plans that weekend, but somehow, with the help of a hidden hand, or perhaps by magic, plans materialized. Indeed, no sooner had the sun set on a perfect Friday afternoon than an unclasped diamond necklace of car headlights lay along the shore of the Baie de Cavalier, flowing toward the gates of Villa Soleil, which blazed and sparkled and pulsed to the beat of music so loud it could be heard across the water, which was the point. The guests traveled from far and wide. There were actors and writers and faded aristocrats and thieves. There was the son of an Italian automaker who arrived amid a school of semi-nude women, and a pop star who had not had a hit record since music went digital. Half the London art world was there, along with a contingent from New York, which, it was rumored, had flown privately across the Atlantic at the host's expense. And there were many others who would later admit to having received no invitation at all. These lesser souls had heard about the affair through the usual channels. The Rivieran gossip mill,
social media, and had beaten the path to Monsieur Antonov's gold-plated door. If he was actually present that night, there was no sign of him. In fact, not a single guest would be able to offer reliable first-hand evidence of having seen him. Even Julian Isherwood, his art advisor, was at a loss to explain his whereabouts. Isherwood conducted a private tour of the villa's impressive collection of old master paintings